Hello, I'm Preston Schleinkofer, and welcome to Civil Defense Radio, where we discuss all things civil defense. What does that mean? In a nutshell, is about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disasters might affect you and your community. This week's episode is about the emerging and re-emerging diseases, the threats to our personal, national, and world health. And back with me again is my guest host, Drew Bumbeck. Hello, Drew. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you doing, Preston?
I'm doing well. The guys next door aren't blowing leaves anymore, so I'm good. We shouldn't have any interruptions with loud noises out there now. But so this topic that we're going to be discussing today is quite troubling when you really get down into the weeds. Can you give us a quick idea of what this is all about?
Yeah, it really is troubling. I think right now everybody is a little aware of this because we had the 2014 through 2016 Ebola outbreak in West Africa that actually affected not just African nations, but with some of the healthcare providers and also some of the folks who traveled from Africa to either Europe or the U.S. You know, you ended up with cascading effects with people getting sick in Europe and in the U.S. And so people are understandably really worried about Ebola, and that's, you know, that one is certainly a nasty one, but there are all sorts of diseases that are either like Ebola, which we've only known about since 1976, and as a matter of fact, they just discovered another strain of Ebola this year, I believe. There are some that are, you know, newly emerging infectious diseases. And then we have other diseases which have been around for a long time. We've known about for more than 50 years, but they, or for hundreds of years in some cases, but they've either never been in the U.S. or we eradicated them from the U.S. and now they're kind of coming back. And some of those are, a number of those are vector-borne diseases, like, you know, they're carried by mosquitoes or by ticks. And so we have all these, or in some cases by rats or mice.
Oh, yeah.
And so we have all these diseases that we're not familiar with from a medical perspective. I mean, most of our physicians have never seen a lot of these things. Our immune systems certainly haven't seen them. So we don't have any herd immunity to these things. A lot of them, there are no vaccines or even any treatments other than supportive treatment, because a lot of them are viral. And so, you know, we've got all these issues we have to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm gonna go down a quick list here, and some of these we may talk about, and others we're gonna leave on the shelf. I picked up in my research. I found this list on a slide presentation from an organization. I can't remember. I think it may have been associated with the World Health Organization, but they list AIDS, avian influenza, Ebola, Marburg, cholera, Rift Valley fever, typhoid, tuberculosis,
leptospirosis.
Yeah, something like that. Malaria, chikungunya, dengue, JE, never heard of JE, and antimicrobial resistance as some of the things that are causing problems around the world.
Yeah. And, you know, there, the other thing too is, you know, you named two groups, or you named members of two groups there that that are particularly troublesome. One is the viral hemorrhagic fevers, so like Ebola and Marburg and Rift Valley fever. And that includes the hemorrhagic fevers are, there's probably 30 or 40 of them in four different viral families. And some are, you know, some are not, well, there's one that doesn't really even affect humans. There are some that don't affect humans, period. But some of them are, like Ebola, are really, really nasty things. And the case fatality rate ranges from anywhere between, the average is around 50, but it ranges from 25 to 90%. And the others that you mentioned are, you know, you mentioned a couple of vector-borne diseases that we're starting to contend with in the U.S. and in the Northern Hemisphere, and that, that we really thought we had either eradicated from the U.S. or we never had in the U.S., like chikungunya, like dengue, Zika, and West Nile, and yellow fever. All of those, except for West Nile, have a common vector. They're all carried by either the Aedes aegypti or the Aedes albopictus mosquitoes. And the Aedes aegypti is the common name, is the yellow fever mosquito. And Aedes albopictus.
And where is that found at?
Oh, that's found pretty much everywhere. Oh,
okay.
Now, theoretically, and the Aedes albopictus is the is another product that China has gotten for us. It's an invasive, the Chinese tiger mosquito. It's an invasive species. Now, both of these are supposedly limited in their range in the U.S. To more temperate areas. They and both of them are. Now, the albopictus is a bit more hardier than the Aedes aegypti, but they're intolerant to cold winters. And the Aedes aegypti, particularly, is supposedly limited to the south of the line with where the average winter temperature doesn't go below 10 degrees Celsius or 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And that in the U.S. kind of bisects, at least in the eastern part of the U.S., bisects Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, and South Carolina. That said, there's recent research that has found population persistence, resident populations in areas north of this line.
Well, ain't that fun?
As a matter of fact, some of the research was done in D.C. and New York, and they have found resident populations, and it shows that they actually can survive over winter in areas that are usually too cold for them. And that's because in big cities, you have microhabitats within urban areas that facilitate their year-round survival, like subterranean areas, like sewers, all the subway. Subway tunnels, et cetera. And so both of these can then overwinter. And while we may not have found, so certainly we don't have yellow fever in North America. It's pretty much found only in Africa and South America and the part of Panama that is east of the canal zone, east of the Panama Canal. And so it has not, it's been eradicated in most of Central America but we have the mosquito that can carry yellow fever. And actually both of them can carry yellow fever. Both of them, and then we have, you know, the diseases like chikungunya, which usually isn't fatal, but it can be extremely painful and debilitating, and can be debilitating for years after one's infected. You have dengue, which is coming back, and we have actually had outbreaks of dengue. You know, it's common in Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, and Samoa, but we've had outbreaks, locally transmitted outbreaks, in Hawaii and in Texas. You know, and we've had, you know, before 2013, there weren't outbreaks of chikungunya outside, you know, they were only cases where travelers had come back from someplace and been infected over there. We've had locally transmitted outbreaks of chikungunya in the Americas, in the Caribbean, starting in 2013. And then we've also had it locally transmitted cases in Florida, Puerto Rico, and the USVI. And then we, of course, have Zika, which, you know, Zika's this newly emerging disease in the U.S. anyway. I mean, it was first identified, and I think the first human cases were in 52 in Uganda. But, you know, Zika seems to have, you know, at least in adults and children, you don't have much in the way of symptoms, unlike, you know, chikungunya or dengue or yellow fever. But you really have mild or no symptoms. But in with Zika, you have this thing too. Not only is it transmitted by the Aedes aegypti and albopictus mosquitoes, but it's also transmitted by sexual intercourse, and it can be transmitted from pregnant women to their fetuses. And you find with Zika, this pregnant women have a lot of problems when they get infected with Zika, because it can cause microcephaly in the infants or other congenital malformations that are, you know, referred to as congenital Zika syndrome. And it can also lead to other complications like preterm birth and miscarriage. And then in adults, you also have, it also seems to have a propensity to affect the nervous system, because people with Zika are at increased risk of neurological complications like Guillain-Barré syndrome, neuropathy, and myelitis, and which are all neurological issues. And sometimes they can be transient. You can have the issues for a while, and then they go away, or they can persist and cause you problems for life.
You know, there's a lot of these things that seem like they circle around every once in a while. Tuberculosis, we almost had that kicked almost completely until we started getting a huge rush of people coming in from Latin America and other countries with tuberculosis, and some of it was resistant to the normal treatment. And so it was like super tuberculosis. And, you know, when I was a Border Patrol agent working on the border in South Texas, we got inoculated for all kinds of things just because we ran into these people all the time, and we were in close proximity in the vehicles and detention and things like that. So, you know, they were, diseases like this were always a concern, but we ran into a lot of people with resistant tuberculosis. That's an ugly thing to have, really.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, unfortunately, we have extensively drug-resistant strains of tuberculosis around now. And it's, unfortunately, you know, it's pretty significant. It's difficult, sometimes impossible to treat. And tuberculosis is a nasty disease to get and a nasty way to die. And it's also, you end up with, it's not just limited to tuberculosis. And you know, we may end up having to do another show on resistance in general, because it's a huge issue, and there you're finding all sorts of different bacteria that are resistant now to most antibiotics.
Now, is that from over medication or what? What causes that?
Okay, so there are a number of factors that cause resistance. For one thing, most antibiotics, not all, but a lot of antibiotics are similar to something found in the wild.
Okay.
So, for example, penicillin actually comes from a mold. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually discovered from, I think it was bread mold. And so a lot of these are natural substances that organisms of one kind or another use to fight off bacteria. In the case of penicillin, it's a chemical that mold uses to fight off bacterial infection. And so a lot of bacteria are exposed to something that's similar to many, you know, one antibiotic or another out in the wild. Sometimes resistance occurs just by chance, by genetic mutation, just by dumb luck. Because when you reassort genes, you know, things arise. And that's how, you know, why every person is different, because, you know, there's a little mutation. And, but a lot of it is due to three or four factors. First off, when you go to the doctor, when you get a cold and you go to the doctor, so, you know, when people go to the doctor with a cold, a lot of times they will say, give me something for this. Give me some penicillin, give me some antibiotics. And research has shown that physicians will, if they are asked for a specific medication, they are much more, or for a specific type of medication, as opposed to, hey, I'm sick, what should I do? You know, they are much more likely to prescribe the requested medication or type. So even though, and the problem there is, most upper respiratory infections people get are not bacterial, they're viral.
Right.
And viruses don't respond to antibiotics. So we then have people taking antibiotics when they don't need them. And that exposes the natural bacteria that are in everybody to these antibiotics. And the problem there is that, you know, well, we're exposing these bacteria, we're killing off the bacteria that aren't resistant, and the bacteria that may have, by dumb luck, through reassortment of genes, developed a resistance to one of these, they hang around. Additionally, most people don't complete the full course of antibiotics. Usually when you're given antibiotics, you're given, depending on the antibiotic, a course of 5, 10, or 14 days. And people will take the antibiotics, and then, you know, after like 7 days, they're feeling better, and they stop taking the antibiotic. Because, well, I'm feeling better, I don't need to take this, okay? And the problem there is, again, you have exposed, let's say you do have a bacterial disease, an infection, instead of a viral one. The person has exposed that bacteria colony in their body to penicillin or, you know, doxycycline or whatever antibiotic they're taking for 5 days or 7 days or 10 days. And instead of taking the full course of 14, they stop. Not every last bacteria has been wiped out. There are still some around, and they have been exposed to this antibiotic. They've gotten used to it, and now it's stopped. And, it hangs around, and it may just be more prevalent. You know, it just may have been hiding better. It may have just had a bit more of a hardiness. But whatever the reason, it's been exposed to this. It's seen the drug, and it can develop a resistance gene. And another place where we have it is we use subtherapeutic doses of antibiotics routinely in agriculture. And they give animals antibiotics subtherapeutically because it helps them grow better. Well, again, they're exposed, the bacteria are exposed to these antibiotics at a subtherapeutic dose. It's not enough to kill them. So they can develop resistance. And the big problem with resistance is if TB develops resistance to antibiotics, or if strep or staph develops resistance to antibiotics, it doesn't stay there. Bacteria are, they all are associated with each other out in the wild somewhere, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like there's one place where there's strep and another place where there's staph and another place where there's TB. They all intermingle from time to time. And when they do, these little buggers share plasmids with each other. And plasmids are these little capsules of DNA information, of genetic information. And usually among the genetic information that bacteria readily share with each other is resistance genes. So that's why we have, you know, all these newly emerging multi-drug or extensive drug resistant bacteria. And so we, you know, as a matter of fact, we have all sorts of STDs that are extensively drug resistant now, like chlamydia and gonorrhea. And, you know, it's just, so resistance is a huge issue.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
And, you know, the other issue that we have, getting back to the viruses, is a lot of viruses, not so much with bacteria, but a lot of the viruses we're finding are extremely persistent in the human body in certain places. They don't necessarily reinfect the person they're in, but they can still be, they can still, for example, Ebola is sexually transmitted.
Yeah, fluid. It has to be some kind of fluid.
Well, there is some discussion on that. There is in several of the outbreaks, there have been anywhere from 6 to 20% of patients who have not had direct contact with an infected person or a known infected carcass. And there's a strain of Ebola that called Ebola Reston. It was discovered first in Reston, Virginia, just outside the nation's capital in a monkey house. Nobody's quite sure where it comes from. It might come from the Philippines. It might come from Indonesia. We're not sure. We haven't found the exact source, and we don't have the reservoir. But Ebola Reston is transmitted by aerosols. So, and as a matter of fact, they have shown that Ebola Reston, you know, it jumped from monkeys in one room to monkeys in another room that never had contact with each other. So there is some question about whether or not Ebola in general might be transmitted by aerosols. It's a controversial thing, and scientists really sometimes get almost violent over it. But Ebola in particular has been found in different bodily fluids up to almost sometimes, in some cases, I think in ocular fluid, almost 6 months after the patient recovered. And it also has persisted in semen upwards of 100 days. So, you know, men can actually, if they get Ebola and then they survive it, almost 3 months later, they can still pass it on because, you know, they're immune now. But if they have sex with somebody, they can give that person Ebola. And so, you know, and it's not just Ebola. I mean, there's, you know, chikungunya, dengue, a number of them are persistent in different bodily fluids for a good long while. And so that means that they're kind of, humans even serve as a reservoir for them. And so, you know, and we also, another one, and this isn't a bacteria or a virus, it's a parasite, but malaria is also an issue. And it's, you know, it can be, and we're seeing more and more cases of it in the U.S. every year, and they're not, you know, from outside. And so,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's an issue. And then another one that a lot of people don't know about are the hantaviruses. The hantavirus is a whole family of diseases, and they're transmitted by, the vector is rodent urine. So, and you have a bunch of different hantaviruses, some of which are, they can be respiratory diseases, or they can be a viral hemorrhagic disease. They can, you know, be essentially a viral hemorrhagic fever almost. They don't cause the bleeding out like Ebola does. But they are, you know, they're pretty much on every continent except for, the Arctic, the Antarctic, I mean.
Yeah.
And, here in the U.S., ours is the sin nombre disease, because.
Oh yeah. Sin nombre. Yeah.
Yeah, and that, you know, it's most common in the desert Southwest, but it can happen pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, so all this to say that there's a lot of things that we really need to be aware of that can happen in a disaster and a lot of these things can spring up from the environment of a severe disaster because of sewage that gets released into a flooded situation, or animals or even humans who drowned in high water and infect the water in the area. There's so many things that we have to know about and prepare for in our preparedness planning for our families, our neighborhoods, and our communities in the civil defense environment. So in last 30 seconds, can you give us a rundown of just some of the things that we should be stocking up on to prepare for such an event of some kind of natural or man-made disaster?
Absolutely. And it's not just, post-disaster. It's in every day, particularly,
Well, that's true, yeah.
Hand sanitizers, like alcohol-based hand sanitizers, soap, and not the antibacterial, because the antibacterial soap actually contributes to bacterial resistance. But soap and water, just regularly washing hands, keeping yourself in good health, taking vitamins. The FDA says, oh, it's not proven, but come on, let's be honest. Zinc and vitamin C do wonders for the immune system. Taking other supplements that help your immune system. Using social distancing. When you see that somebody's sick, stay away from them. Or if you're sick, don't go to school or work. Don't spread it.
Yeah.
Cover your cough. If you're sick or sneezing, put, cough or sneeze into the crook of your arm.
Yeah.
Your elbow. Right there at the elbow.
That's why God made it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And just common sense things that a lot of people just don't do. And I don't know why they don't, but watch those things.
Yeah.
Avoid situations where you're going to get sick if at all possible.
Yeah. Well, our friends and listeners out there, I encourage you to be very, very careful this winter and have a plan. Stay fortified and keep things around you that can help keep your hands clean. And if you just happen to, somebody coughs on you or sneezes on you, pop some On Guard blend or On Guard beadlets. They really help, man. I've got personal testimonies that I'd love to say, but the FDA would shut me down. But anyways, I appreciate your wisdom and the information that you shared with us today, Drew. And civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. Be resilient. It takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with our guide at civildefenseradio.com. On our resources page. Be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook, which is where I post most of the stuff on a regular basis, at Civil Defense Radio, and on Twitter at civil_def_radio. And again, I'd like to thank our friends and listeners out there. And Drew, thank you again. And I really appreciate everybody being on the show this week. So please be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.